Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Reza Aslan is a religious scholar, a TV producer and host. He's written about Islam, Jesus, and in his latest book, he takes a scholarly look at God and the origins of religion. It's called God, A Human History. Aslan is a professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside, and a graduate of the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. He'll be speaking in Iowa City tonight at the First United Methodist Church in Iowa City in a Prairie Lights bookstore event at 7 p.m., and he is here with me now. Hello, Reza.
Hello, it's nice to speak with you.
Well, it's so nice to have you here. And in the introduction of your book, you write about how your personal concept of God has changed over time. How did you think about God when you were a child?
Well, pretty much the way I think all children, regardless of culture or background, think of God, which is basically as a kind of superhuman being. With human characteristics and human limitations. There have been some very interesting psychological work done on children and their perceptions of the divine. And it turns out, as I kind of talk about in the book, that this kind of view of God with human emotions and human attributes and a human personality is it's a compulsion that's kind of baked into our cognitive processes.
So kind of the old man in the bathrobe that looks a lot like Zeus.
That's it. Yeah. There's a reason why that image is so universal. Some of the earliest images of the gods that we have made by Mesopotamians, those images themselves show a kind of old man, usually with a kind of beard, usually sitting on a throne of some sort. It is a universal impulse, but it's not a cultural one. It seems that, as the evidence suggests, it's a cognitive impulse.
Well, you write in your introduction that in some ways that idea, that concept of God, primed you to embrace evangelical Christianity when you were 15 years old because of the very human Jesus that you encountered.
Yeah, I mean, look, in many ways the book presents the history of human spirituality as one long, interconnected, and remarkably cohesive attempt to make sense of God by giving God human attributes and emotions and motivations and even a human body, until, of course, in the person of Jesus, God becomes literally a human being. And I think part of the reason why Christianity is the most successful religion in the history of the world is precisely because it, in many ways, fully gives in to that human impulse, that desire to humanize God. Christianity says, well, you want to know what God is? God is a perfect human being, perfectly loving, perfectly compassionate, perfectly kind. And in many ways, I think, it wasn't just me, but I think for a lot of people, that understanding of the divine in fully human terms promotes a relational experience with the divine. Like, it's very easy, I think, to understand God, to have a relationship with God if you think of God as a person, as an actual human being.
Many books, of course, have been written on religion, our relationships with religion. Your book goes back to the very beginning, the origins of religion, and we'll talk more about those in a moment. But what was it that sparked this journey? Why go back to the very beginning as you see it?
Right. Well, first, let's differentiate. So it's not, my book doesn't go back to the origin of religion. The origin of religion, I mean, we can say with maybe some measure of confidence that can go back 14, 15,000 years ago. I'm interested in the origin of the religious impulse. So to put it in another term, the origin of faith, right? The origin of belief. And that you know, the evidence suggests goes back deep, deep into our prehistoric past. In fact, it very likely predates the existence of Homo sapiens as a species, as we have found numerous examples of material evidence indicating the existence of a spiritual idea, faith, religious belief, however you want to define it, in Neanderthals and even among Homo erectus. And, you know, as I began to really delve into that prehistoric past, looking for ways to explain how and why the religious impulse arose in our human evolution, the thing that I think I was most surprised by was precisely the fact that this is an impulse that predates us. And if that's the case, then it is deeply embedded in our cognitive functions. We are, as I sometimes joke, homo religiosus.
So let's talk about the evidence that you see and that others see for religious practices, or that spark of faith, the beginning before the beginning. Looking back at the archaeological record, you cite cave art, for example, as giving us evidence of that.
That's right. Yeah, we certainly see it in the sort of spectacularly painted caves that dot the landscape of Europe and Asia, but frankly can be found as far afield as Australia. We have now found caves on the remote islands of Indonesia that were painted at the same time that the caves in parts of Europe were painted, approximately 40,000 years ago. We have found caves that actually painted caves that predate the emergence of Homo sapiens in Europe. So that means that they were painted by Neanderthals. And it's quite clear when you look at these caves that whatever was happening here had some kind of spiritual significance to it, that what we are witnessing is something akin to a subterranean sanctuary, a kind of prehistoric temple where clearly you see the evidence of ritual behavior. But we can go back much, much further than 40,000 years. I mean, one of the best archaeological examples that we have for the existence of spiritual belief can be found in graves. I mean, understand that the very idea of burying a dead body in and of itself indicates some kind of ritual function. There's just no reason to bury a dead person. It's extremely expensive, materially expensive with regard to time and effort, things that should be spent on survival. But not only do we bury the dead, we bury them in deliberately ritualistic fashion, often in certain poses or buried along with things that they possessed in their lives, things that they would need in the life to come. And so that alone, the idea that there was a life to come, is an expression of that religious impulse. You know, we have Homo sapien graves that go back 100, 120,000 years old. We have Neanderthal graves that go back even further than that. We have even evidence of Homo erectus graves that show signs of ritual behavior. In general, however, I think all of this sort of belies a fundamental problem with relying on material evidence in the first place, because, you know, it's one thing to dig something up out of the ground, to date it, and say, oh, look, this is a 200,000-year-old object that clearly had some sort of ritual significance. But the important thing to understand is that just because that object is 200,000 years old doesn't mean that the belief that led to the creation of that object is also 200,000 years old. Like, obviously, we had certain beliefs about the nature of the universe long before we began carving those beliefs out of rock or painting them inside of a cave. And so, as I argue in the book, we need to actually look past that material evidence and instead start looking to the kind of brain that is necessary in order to conceive of these kinds of religious functions. And that brain is, as I was saying earlier, deeply a part of our evolution as human beings. It's a cognitive impulse that's embedded in our brains. It's deeply a part of who we are.
Well, we'll talk more about that in just a moment. I'm talking with Reza Aslan. His latest book is God, A Human History. He'll be speaking in Iowa City tonight at the First United Methodist Church in a Prairie Lights bookstore event. It's at 7 p.m. this evening. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me now is Reza Aslan. His latest book takes on a big subject. It's God, A Human History. Aslan's a professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. He's a graduate of the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. He's written, of course, about Islam, about Jesus, and now taking on God. And just before the break, we were talking about this early evidence for ritualistic behavior, this evidence of faith that comes even before Homo sapiens. Neanderthals, Homo erectus, you can see evidence. You were talking about the brain that really allows this kind of ritualistic behavior, this kind of belief to develop. Do you think that there is an evolutionary adaptation for faith in humans?
Well, so this is the central puzzle that evolutionary theorists and cognitive scientists are facing. What is undeniable is that the religious impulse is a universal phenomenon. It exists among all people, among all cultures, among all parts of the world, throughout all of time, and in fact, even before our species, Homo sapiens, existed. So if that's the case, and it is, then that means there must be some evolutionary reason for it. There must be some adaptive advantage to the religious impulse. And we've spent most of the last 200 years trying to come up with what that adaptive advantage will be. And the fact of the matter is that every answer that we have proposed has failed, has fallen short. And the consensus now among most cognitive theorists, most evolutionary theorists, is that there is no adaptive advantage for the religious impulse, and that if anything, it might be an accident, and that as a result of that thing, religion and religious belief became this kind of accidental universal phenomenon. I think just as good of a theory is that it's not an accident, that it's by design, that we are meant to actually think that there is more than just the sum of our material bodies, that universal impulse is there because it is how we are supposed to understand the world and our place in it. Again, that's also unprovable. So it really comes back to the individual choice as to what they believe, why they believe this impulse exists. But what isn't up for debate is the universality of this impulse. In fact, I was mentioning studies done on children and you know, to gauge sort of spirituality and the universal nature of it. One of the most fascinating studies done on children has indicated that regardless of whether they come from a religious family or not, or whether they're raised in the East or the West, that children are born with an innate acknowledgement, an innate understanding of what theorists sometimes refer to as substance dualism, the belief that the mind and the body are separate and distinct. And you can replace the word mind with soul if you want to. You can call it psyche if you want. You can call it Buddha nature if you want. You can call it Brahman if you want. You know, there's many words for it, but the idea that whatever we are, includes both material and immaterial selves, apparently is inborn. We are born with that belief. It's something that is not it's something that's not learned. It's a thing that has to become unlearned, in fact.
I want to push back a little bit because I think something else that you could say is universal in all human cultures all over the world would be superstition, which a lot of people theorize arises from our need to make sense of the world or to come up with rules that will keep us safe, to identify danger. Wouldn't that same idea also explain religious ideas and those patterns of belief that may keep us safe and avoid danger?
Well, superstition is just a pejorative for the religious impulse and religious belief. You know, it's a value judgment. So, in other words, you know, my religious belief is religious, and your religious belief is just superstition. So it goes back to the idea of religion. And so you seem to be suggesting that the reason that it exists is an attempt to explain the mysteries of the universe. And it's certainly true that religion provides answers, unspecific answers, to the great mysteries of the universe. But there is zero reason to believe that that is an adaptive advantage, that in any way, shape, or form, having answers to the mysteries of the universe allows you to survive more than someone who doesn't have those answers. And so that becomes the fundamental problem. And there, by the way, there are many other examples, you know, that you mentioned another one, this idea of it creates a sense of rules or structure or morality even. And so that could be an adaptive advantage. We've been talking about that for a very, very long time. It's true that religion does provide moral guidance and indeed even a divine lawgiver, but it's equally true that the concept of religious morality is barely 5,000 years old. You don't have to go all the way back into deep into our prehistory to understand that there was no role to play with regard to moral guidance when it came to religious belief. Just look at the Mesopotamians, at the Egyptians, at the Greeks, at the ancient Persians, the Indo-Europeans. All of these very well-developed religious institutional pantheons came with no morality whatsoever. The Greek gods were not the source of human morality. The Egyptian gods were not the source of human morality. What we call the idea of divine law or divine morality, as I say, is barely 5,000 years old.
One of the interesting things you write about is the relationship, or what you see as the relationship, between early religions and the rise of agriculture. Explain that relationship to me.
Right, right. Well, this is sort of one of the most intriguing theories out there to answer a problem that has only recently come to light. I think most people just simply assumed that the rise of agriculture, the agricultural revolution, the transition from being hunter-gatherers to being farmers and domesticators was a good thing, that it was actually a massive leap in human evolution, that it resulted in more stable food supplies and even larger food supplies. But over the last two decades, research has proven that the exact opposite is true, that the transition from hunting and gathering to farming and domesticating was a de-evolution. It was a terrible idea. Not only did it lead to far less food and far fewer calories, we know this by the fact that mortality rates were devastated by the transition to agriculture, but we also know this because of the simple fact that we've unearthed skeletons during the early years of the rise of agriculture that indicate a whole host of new and novel diseases and ailments that simply did not exist in our hunter-gathering ancestors. And frankly, I mean, when you start to really think about it, it kind of makes some logical sense. I mean, after all, when you are a hunter-gatherer, you have almost unlimited supplies of animals. You just go to where the animals are. If any particular species of animal starts to thin out, you just hunt some other species of animal. If any particular grain or barley or anything that you are gathering and picking starts to become in short supply, you pick something else. But the farmer has no choice but to essentially live or die based on the success of his or her crop. If disease comes through the crops, or if there's a drought, the crops die, the farmer and his family dies. If one of your animals that you have penned gets sick, the whole herd gets sick, the animals die, you die, your entire family dies. The great Israeli historian Yuval Hariri has this great line where he says that it turns out that the agricultural revolution was basically history's greatest fraud. It was just a bad bet. And so we've been kind of struggling to figure out why. Why did we do something that was such a bad idea in the first place? And at the same time, a series of new finds that we have found across the Levant and in southern Turkey has kind of scrambled our timeline a little bit. You see, we always assumed that the reason we stopped wandering and we settled down was because we began planting crops. And so by planting crops, we had no choice but to actually stop moving around and take care of those crops. But now we have the evidence of very large, very advanced settled societies that existed thousands of years before the rise of agriculture. So in other words, we had stopped moving around for millennia before it occurred to us to actually start planting seeds or penning animals. And so in one of the more fascinating reasons for why we began planting has arisen from scholars of religion who have noted that in these settled societies, these societies that actually created large settlements before the rise of agriculture, that what we find in all of these are fairly elaborate, sometimes spectacularly so, religious temples. And so it seems like what very likely may have happened is that we went from carrying our gods around with us to eventually deciding to create essentially homes for those gods, temples. And then the process of building those temples forced us to settle around those temples. And then eventually, simply because we were no longer moving around and it was becoming more and more difficult to go get food and bring it back, eventually we did something that was at first a terrible idea. We started planting. We started domesticating our animals. And more interestingly, that actually transformed our very sense of self, because when we were hunter-gatherers, we thought of ourselves as one with nature. We shared the same essence as the natural world around us. But here now, for the first time, we were manipulating nature, exploiting nature for our own purposes by domesticating animals, by literally terraforming the earth. And that created a fundamental shift in the way that we thought about human beings. In a way, we became the lords of the earth, if you will.
You also speculate that that led or was part of the shift toward humanizing the divine, because when we look at very early faith systems, we see a lot of animism, you know, imbuing inanimate objects with spirit. But we see really early evidence for this sort of humanistic approach to gods and the divine.
Correct, correct. So, I mean, this is a cognitive impulse. It is something that's just kind of, it's a compulsion that we have in our brains to think of the divine in human terms. But when we begin the process of actualizing that impulse by, for instance, creating idols or building temples, creating places for the gods to live, we begin to actually, you know, put that impulse into play. We begin to carve the gods in human terms with human bodies. We begin to dress the god with clothes because we need clothes. We need food, so therefore the gods need food. So we start to give them sacrifices. We need shelter, so therefore the gods need shelter. So then we start to build them these temples. And then, of course, that all accelerates even much more rapidly once writing is invented. Once we begin to write about the gods, then that impulse, that humanizing impulse, really becomes fully formed, fully actualized, when we begin to put the gods in some kind of scenario, say at the creation of the world, or in the midst of debating some issue with regard to human beings, we have no choice but to have the gods act out, to think and talk just like we would in that scenario. And so this unconscious impulse becomes consciously realized, both in our idols and in our writings about the gods.
We need to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Reza Aslan. His most recent book is God, A Human History. He'll be in Iowa City tonight at the First United Methodist Church. It's a Prairie Lights bookstore event at 7 p.m. this evening, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Reza Aslan. He's a religious scholar, a television producer and host. He's written about Islam, Jesus. His latest book takes a look at God and the origins of religion, the origins of faith. It's called God, A Human History. And Reza, just before the break, we were talking about how writing really changed our ability to communicate faith, to communicate religion, about this human impulse to humanize the divine. And I think a lot of us are familiar with, let's say, the Egyptian gods and the Greek gods, these families of very human-like, powerful divine beings that also not only have power and really represent some of our best qualities, but also our worst qualities. And you write that with the Greek gods, they became so human, you feel that actually undermined the religion.
Yes, perfectly said. I mean, that's exactly right. You know, by the time we get to the ancient Greeks, we're talking about some of the greatest technological advances of the time with regard to the ability to carve these gods in these beautiful humanistic forms out of marble. I mean, we're talking about some of the great wonders of the world. At the same time, when you look at the writings of the great poets Homer or Hesiod, you have these Greek myths in which the gods are presented in such three-dimensional ways that they just pop off the page. You know, they seem so eminently human. They have the same struggles that we do, the same emotions that we have, the same motivations. And particularly when it comes to the Olympian gods, you know, people tend to forget that the Olympian gods are all related. They're all one gigantic family. And these myths do read kind of like a soap opera, you know, with Zeus constantly sneaking around on Hera in order to have affairs, and then hearing it from her when he gets caught, and, you know, his sons and daughters fighting amongst themselves for his favor. And part of that, I think, is remarkable in that, you know, if you are just a Greek person, a Greek devotee, you look at the gods, you see them as one giant family struggling with the same issues that your family is dealing with, and it creates a connection between you. But there were a number of Greek philosophers, people like Xenophanes, people like Plato, who couldn't help but notice how ridiculously human these gods were. Is it the case that Zeus could look exactly like one of us, not just a human being, but an ethnically Greek human being? You know, it was kind of like what I called the jump the shark moment, if you will, for the humanization impulse. And for the first time, you get two very interesting trends. One of those trends is what we now refer to as atheism, a Greek word that means without God. This idea that, well, maybe there is no God at all, because if there is, this can't be God. I cannot accept that, you know, these maudlin adventures represent, you know, these universal deities, immortal deities. So maybe it's all just a lie. Or the other side of the argument, which you start to hear again from people like Plato and Xenophanes is this notion that if there is a God, then that God can't be human, can't have any human qualities whatsoever. It must be a dehumanized God, and most importantly, it must be a singular God, a God without body, without form, without substance, a God that is essentially the animating force of the universe. And these two trends that come out of Greece essentially create, you know, the modern religious idea.
Although it's a long journey from there, the path toward just one God is not nearly as simple as I think a lot of us have been led to believe.
You're right.
I don't think we have time to talk about that entire journey. But one of the really fascinating things that you write about is in looking at the Bible and looking at the mythology behind the Egyptian gods and the beliefs of the Sumerians, you see these threads, these myths that are perpetuated and become biblical. And you point out that this journey toward a single God, you can see evidence of it in the Bible, a reconciliation between two gods, Yahweh and El, and all of these traditions being sewn together in this book or library of small books.
Well, I mean, I think it is extraordinary that in the hundreds of thousands of years that we can say with some measure of confidence there was such a thing as human spirituality, the idea of a single soul God is barely 2,500 years old. And as you rightly say, it's not that it didn't come up before. It did. It's just that when it did, it was immediately rejected, sometimes violently so. And it goes back to the principal theory that we've been talking about. Human beings are more than comfortable with the existence of conflicting emotions, conflicting attributes within themselves. But they don't understand why those conflicting attributes and emotions would exist in a singular God. It just makes way more sense to think that there is a different God for each one of our attributes, a God of love and a God of war, a fatherly God, a motherly God, a good God, an evil God. The ancient mind has a much easier time making sense of that than the idea that there is one God who is both father and mother, who is both good and evil, who is all these things at once. And whenever somebody proposed such a thing, it was rejected. And you're right that if you read the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, what you see is this kind of slow reconciliation of this idea. Abraham was not a monotheist. Abraham's God was El, a Canaanite deity. That makes sense since Abraham spent his entire life in Canaan. Moses was not a monotheist. Moses' God was Yahweh, a Median / Egyptian deity, which makes sense since Moses was Egyptian. And what you see when you read the Bible in a historical sense is this slow merging of these two gods, El and Yahweh, into eventually, thanks to the existential crisis of the Babylonian exile, which took place around 586 BC, the slow merging of these two gods into what we now know as the singular one God of the universe.
And, of course, there are still different interpretations of that singular one God
still, yeah.
Of the universe. It's interesting. You write about your personal journey, which is very Sufi influenced, but it also, in some ways, it sounds like an echo of what you were just saying about the Greek philosophers, Xenophanes, the idea of God, a one God, a singular God, but not a humanistic idea, not humanizing the divine.
Yes, I think that's exactly right, is that I feel like in many ways the history that I present in the book, it also matches my own personal journey and sort of this movement towards making an effort to think about God not as a divine personality who looks and thinks and acts and feels just like me, but as, well, as we were just saying a moment ago with the Greeks and with our ancient ancestors, as the divine force of the universe. I came to that idea through Sufism, which is a pantheistic religion, the belief that there can be no division between creator and creation, that God is everything, that God is all, which is what pantheism means. But I do think it's important to understand that that's not a solely Sufi idea, that idea exists in almost all religious traditions, and it goes back, as I say, to probably our first spiritual expressions. And the reason that I end the book with this kind of full-throated argument about thinking about God in these terms, not in humanistic terms, but in pantheistic terms, is because, well, not only do I think that it can lead to a deeper spirituality, a deeper and more meaningful spirituality, but I do think that if we can learn to stop foisting our own emotions, our own biases and bigotries upon God, if we can stop thinking of God as just a divine version of ourselves, then I think we can pave the path to a much more peaceful religiosity, much deeper connections between different peoples of faith, instead of, you know, what we've seen so much when it comes to religion, which can be a force for good and a force for evil. Which, of course, makes sense, because if it is just a reflection of ourselves, then everything good and bad about our religions is just everything good and bad about ourselves.
Earlier, you mentioned this idea that children are born with a predisposition for substance dualism, the idea that maybe this is evidence that we have souls because we have this predisposition to understand ourselves in that way. But our predisposition to humanize God doesn't lead you to believe that God is like a human. Why? How do you reconcile that?
Well, I think what I say in the book is, in a way, I think we should sort of give in to that metaphor and recognize that perhaps the reason that we do construct God as a divine version of ourselves is because there is a fundamental truth to this idea of pantheism, which is that we are God, all of us. Are God, that all things are God, that God just simply is, and that's precisely the kind of spirituality that I think is ripe for the world in which we live, a world where religion is increasingly used to justify violence and bigotry, where religion is being manipulated to promote rank explicitly political agendas, where more and more people are choosing to say that they are spiritual but not religious because they don't want to take on the baggage of dogma and doctrine. And I feel like thinking about God in these pantheistic terms provides a kind of avenue for spiritually inclined people to have a deep, meaningful spiritual life without necessarily the trappings of religion.
Reza Aslan, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Reza Aslan is the author most recently of God, A Human History. He will be in Iowa City tonight speaking at the First United Methodist Church. It's a Prairie Lights Bookstore event at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.